Hello and welcome to Dealing with Doing Good, a series where we explore the challenges and meanings of doing good in a complicated world. In each episode, we sit down with people who are trying to make a living in the world of development. We bring in grassroots workers, academic researchers, young professionals working with government bodies, and our everyday Good Samaritans. Join us as we discuss with our guests the motivations, anxieties, and realizations which drive them. I'm your host, Nishtha Tiwari.
And I'm Kapil Vachra.
And today we have with us Jesha Kaushik. Jesha is a development practitioner who has been working in the field of education. She has been in the development sector since 2018 after completing her master's in development studies. Hi, Jesha.
Hi, Nishtha. Hi, Kapil. So happy to be here.
So we'll be talking about education and development today. And Jesha, if you want to share with us briefly what brought you into this field and into this particular area.
So I started my career in the development sector. I think it was motivated by the interest I had studying the social sciences in my undergrad and development studies, like the interdisciplinary studies that I did in my postgrad, and just growing up seeing work in the social sector and wanting to contribute to that. With education in particular, it's always been an interest of mine. And so after my initial foray into the development sector, I sought out jobs specifically on education projects, and I've worked on them in two different states in India. And I think I really enjoyed it because I think the classroom is a very interesting, very dynamic space. It's always fun to work with kids, although I haven't always directly worked with them, but it's a really exciting space to be in. And that's what brought me there.
That's nice to hear. One question I wanted to ask was, we brought in a lot of other people on this podcast who've often come from other fields. And I'm someone who also did development studies and then entered the development sector. So do you want to talk about that a bit? How was it studying development and then entering the sector and seeing what's going on here?
Thanks for that, Nishtha. And as you know, you and I go way back in the sector. So I'm really happy to be discussing this with you. Much as social science graduates love to talk about the MBAs who are coming into our sector and telling us how to run NGOs like businesses, I got to say, I look back and think, wow, I studied this and then I got in here. Like, interesting set of choices were made by me. I do think it's a lot of people I see are studying development studies or are trying to get into the social sector, you know, through education as well, or like are choosing to do masters in this kind of field later in their careers. And I just think it's interesting to see like what motivates that, like whether they had an interest in it from the beginning or whether they started working and then had an interest in policy and went towards that for education. And I just think it's interesting to observe that without scrutinizing my own choices too much, because I'm a little afraid of what I will find if I do that. So
But was there any like disruption between what you studied and what you found here, or did you think it was very similar in terms of like college mein bata diya tha yehi hone wale sector mein, and then when we entered waisa hi tha?
That's funny that you talk about disruption, because I feel like my professors were very clear on the critiques of development in masters itself. Like they were like, haan, ye sab to ye sare agents hain, sirf hum achhe hain jo academia karte hain, you know. So that's what really annoyed me, because I'm just like, why? I'm just like, literally ivory tower mein baith ke they're doing this. I am going to go and get my hands dirty and really work, you know. And they were correct. Some things they said were correct. I'm not gonna give academics the satisfaction, sorry Nishtha, but some of those things were on point for sure.
I'm actually kind of curious to understand, like, as someone who had like, I obviously knew about the social development sector, but I had no experience with it. So like, as an outsider, you always have this, and I see this even when I'm talking to my friends or people who are not in the sector. When I share about my work, they're like, oh, you're doing this very wonderful work because you're talking about working with adolescent girls, boys, around like health services. So like, there is a very pristine and clean perception. for you guys, like, what was that majoritarian perspective for people who are working in the, who are aiming to enter into the development studies space or into the social sector space? I'm kind of curious about that.
Firstly, Kapil, it was more like, acha, undergraduate mein aise humanities kar liya, like, you know, social science kar liya. Ab aage kya hi kar loge, you know, like one of the things was also like, yeah, this does seem like a natural progression to go further into this situation and work in the social sector. So there was that as well. I'm also so interested by what you say, like this pristine image. I think this is there when there's like, you tell anyone who's not in the sector, like, you know, family, friends, or anyone that you do work, or any new people you meet, that, you know, you work for an NGO, and they just think like you're the most pure, the loveliest person in the world. They're like, wow, that's so fulfilling. Like, you know, it's fully, and I don't know how to tell them, like, I'm actually not that great of a person, like, sorry to say this, but, like, you know, but yeah, I think what drew me was just the fact that it seemed like a natural application of the social sciences, and I had role models growing up who were doing this kind of work, although I would say charity work and development work are still two different things, and in our country it's conflated quite a bit, like volunteering work, you know, things like that. There are many different types of charities, so that is what brought me here. And I think mid-career a lot of people do that shift as well, to do something more fulfilling, to do something more satisfying, to work for the world. So I've seen that happening with people also. So
That's kind of interesting, because like one other I maybe just taking a step back, because yeah, there is definitely a large population which is like, oh, you're doing something very beautiful. But if I take the example of my family, so where I really wanted to go into the social development sector, right, like around 11th and 12th grade, and I was very adamant about it, and my mom just couldn't absorb that, to the point that she took me to a career counselor, and the career counselor was trying to explain to me, he's like, why are you going into this? There's no money into this. And after all of these years, after working across like these very typical areas which are seen as a marker for like success, like tech and coming back to this space, everybody I meet feels like, what is wrong with you? Especially in West Delhi, like that's where I come from. Here, if you're working in the social development sector, it is not necessarily seen as, wow, you're working in this beautiful thing. They might say that very superficially, but I know underneath it, the larger line of questioning has always been like, what are you really doing? You're just wasting your life.
Yeah, I think that's there. The you are a Sonpari sort of narrative that comes because people essentially follow that up with questions like, so do you get a salary? Like, they don't think it's a real job. Like, they just think you're like, I don't know, you're just like, you know, providing food at an orphanage or something. Like, they don't. So I think that is also where it comes from. Like, oh, so sweet. Her heart is so pure. Like, she's doing this out of the good. Like, she doesn't have to sustain herself or anything like that. So it's also that. I also find it so interesting when people say, what are you doing? Because that is sometimes what I tell people who want to study or get further into this field in this economy. Like, I feel like the development sector and NGOs in India were very different in the late 1980s and 1990s than they are now. So I think it's kind of, I think, what do they call it? It's like that horseshoe theory, the political thing, that you go so far into critiques of things that you're just like, actually, wo pehle wala position hi sahi tha. So I feel like that's kind of where I am. I feel like Nishtha will also agree. Even I will say, Kapil, I will be united in West Delhi with West Delhi and say, Kapil, what are you doing? Why are you in this field? Why, what are you doing with your life? So, yeah.
Kapil, so do you have any answer to that? What are you doing? Why are you in this field?
I think that's a subject for a separate podcast. Maybe Nishtha, you can share what your experience was.
Yeah, I think mera bhi yahi tha, because I'd done humanities, but I had done English. So, you know, English, with you had a lot of bleeding arts types, and you had a lot of people who were very like abstract and pure thinkers. And then you had these people who were like, oh, you know, like, we've come into literature because we love reading and we just feel so much. And they sort of conflated, because you have to choose your bachelor so early in India that they're just, and we can go into that when we talk about education, which is the the main subject of this podcast. But yeah, a lot of people who come into English are actually just people who love reading and who feel a lot of things. So English maane ke baad, they're just like, kahan aa gaye? Hame political science padhni chahiye thi, sociology padhni chahiye thi. We just liked reading. And now we're in this discipline that we don't understand. A lot of people actually go into the dev sector from English also, because they just feel so much that they want to do good. And yeah, once you're doing a master's, I think they tell you, they basically tell you ki kuch nahi rakha hai dev sector mein, like to actually practice it, you shouldn't go there. But then you have a lot of, I think if you don't want to go into academia, there are very few options after development. Like it's just a bit of a sham field where they've created this big discipline. Either you can just like go into the discipline and become an academic, or you can like sort of see kya kya padh liya and now make sense of it in a practitioner world which is still 20 years behind in terms of the theory. So it becomes quite difficult to navigate that. I also, when I joined, there was a lot of, in my master's, it's spoken a lot about how that funding and paisa kahan pe hai, and you want to go into these systems of power and actually want to allocate funds in the right way, and people with the right sort of bent of mind need to be in these positions. But once you enter the field, you actually see how problematic that can be as well. Like you might be stuck in a structure where even though you have some control over the budgets are already fixed to such a great extent that there's only so much you can maneuver. Even in project objectives, there's only so much you can maneuver. Yeah, but I think the disruption per se for me came from the fact that even though academia sort of informs you of all the problems, they don't really inform you of the practicalities and the realities of how the dev sector in India operates. And there's a lot of stuff, I think, which academia has actually not been engaging with very well. One of which particularly is that they talk about, you know, they talk about how these narratives operate in the third world, but they don't complicate the idea of who in the third world is actually working on these issues, who are the people in positions of power, what are their sort of mentalities. So they'll talk about like funding redirect ho rahi hai, but they're not really talking about kahan redirect ho rahi hai and what kind of narratives are being repropagated in these fields as well. And I think in that sense, academia has a lot further to go. They've sort of skipped that jump of practically kya ho raha hai and studying that, and they've just gone straight into development kaam nahi karta. But development mein abhi bhi itna paisa hai, so like you still need to figure out ways of making it work better.
An interesting line of thought. So then I have a question for you guys, and I know this is a generalization, so let's put that giant asterisk next to it. In your experience, what do you feel? Do you feel like having a rigorous background or understanding of social development sector before entering it, is that useful or not? Because in my experience as a designer, and this is a very common problem with designers, or because you're taught through design throughout your education, you can solve anything and there is no end to it. And because you have, in the past 10-15 years, design has been put on this like massive podium, people are obsessed with like their apps, their phones, digitizing everything. There is this perception you can cure everything, you can fix everything. So when I see a lot of designers coming into this space, including me, there is a very pristine mindset of, oh yeah, these problems are so much simpler. It's much better than building an app, because that was terrible, because I had to work for 5,000 people. But here, oh, I have to work with 10 people. And out of these 10 people, maybe two of my donors, I have to convince, I can do that. And I saw that, and I saw with a lot of the designers that I've worked with, even though like the pay was not necessarily good, even though things were as messy as you guys were telling us, are sharing, it was still this idea of like, I can fix everything. And eventually that kind of ends out and you start seeing the reality more and more. It's something like, even one of our co-founders at Commonplace, Pradhan, who comes from the advertising space, similar to me, had a very similar experience. Advertising space is a jungle, it's a hell. And coming here, everything seems very pristine. So, going back to that question, do you feel like having knowledge and understanding of the space, obviously the academic theoretical part is obviously going to help you a bit in the long run, but do you feel that experiential knowledge is beneficial when you're going to enter into a space where it's very easy to go down a hole of questioning what you're doing and existential crisis?
Firstly, I think Nishtha set the context really well just now when she was talking about the development sector and academia and how it interacts. And you've also taken it further. So I really like that. I would say that, disclaimer, I think I have a lot of anti-academia views due to a potential, maybe failed career in academia. So you can take that with a pinch of salt, however you want. I really feel what's super important to have in the development sector, that people either learn through working in it and understanding and seeing the problems firsthand, being on field, or even working within a development team. I feel it. I think it, the entire spectrum of human emotions and problems can be felt within an NGO, within a team. I think it is not always academic knowledge that has helped me, but it's rather the existence of different approaches to development and understanding that these are political approaches. Like what you just said, right? Like this is very in fashion now, what I would want to call solutionism, that there's every, and especially because that, you know, we are seeing like this design research trend in development, and everything is about human-centered design. And it's been around for some time, but it's, I think, getting a little trendier, maybe with like behavioral economics, how to nudge people's behavior, how to design an intervention, but to make sure that it actually affects behavioral change. Because I think people have now warmed down to the idea that like an intervention is not just about, you know, distributing aid, humanitarian aid. It's also about maybe affecting a kind of behavioral change that later makes sure that your donors are happy. I think that this is one strand, one way to go about it, you know, to do this, to find solutions to everything, to see everything as fixable, to see everything as measurable, and just collect data and you know, figure it out, solve it, and solve for. Like, I don't know if you're, I mean, this term is something that you heard, but it was something that said a lot where I've worked. How do we solve for this? And it used to annoy me to no end, because why would we get algebra into development? But anyway, that's something else. So just to know that, you know, the kind of problems of inequality that are faced in a country like India, the kind of issues, we can talk even about education, access to education, discrimination in educational spaces, you know, things like that, in higher education, in primary, any place, teachers not being paid well enough, to understand that these are all essentially, like, you know, part of the same conversation, and to understand that, you know, there are different approaches. Like, we are all trying to solve problems like inequality in access in education, or, you know, the fact that people don't know that this particular service is available, so you need to create an app for it. To create an app is one way of solving it, but there are other approaches to the problem as well that the development sector doesn't necessarily focus on. So I feel, for me, I understood some of that. Like, I understood some idea of like the politics of the development sector in my academic, like, because I would say, because I studied the social sciences, I understood some of that. I wouldn't necessarily say academia is the way to necessarily understand all of that, because I don't want to give academia the satisfaction. But a lot of things I feel people understand also by working in these spaces, by interacting a lot with colleagues who come from a lot of different backgrounds or different political viewpoints or different attitudes towards development. I feel that is something that is learned there. And I think that's really important, because a lot of people simply don't know or don't realize that there are other ways to even imagine change. Like, people would really think that to find a solution, to solve everything, to plug this gap, to fix this pipe, that is how development works, or that is how changing society works. And I'm bringing up this larger thing in it, because that's how development at least is sold to a lot of people, to funders as well as people who work in it alike, that we are trying to make sure every child gets into school. We are trying to eliminate all inequality to access, which is fundamentally not a fixable problem in the way we know how to fix. That is how I think of it. But a lot of people think of it in that sense. And their educational background has some role to play in that, but I wouldn't say that awareness of the world or political awareness is necessarily through the kind of education that you had.
based on that answer, we can actually move into that's the actual topic of what we came here to discuss today. And I think this is a big theme that's across thematic areas. It's been coming up, that idea of technicalization and individualization of solutioning. And there is a sort of, at least in the work that I did, there was a lot of disdain for, you know, historicizing a problem or politicizing a problem. And just not accepting that there are certain solutions which have been worked upon. Like, they may not have been developed as an app, but they have been worked upon for a long time, for decades even. And one instance which comes to mind is there was someone I was working with in the research center I worked at earlier. And there's also this trend of bringing in a lot of young people now, right? Like, who work for 1 or 2 years and then leave. And so this person was in charge of like some really big projects, and she was working on a project on, what was it? Livelihood generation. And she's just talking about how, you know, it's very difficult to effect change because some of these policies have been around for 10, 12 years. And that was her scope of thinking. Like, that's how far back she could imagine. She could imagine a policy going back 12 years at best. And I was just shocked. I was like, you know, like, these policies have been around for centuries now. Like, there's so much that plays into health. There's so much that plays into education. And they've been around for so many decades, both in terms of policy, but also in terms of history. And I think those debates are really missing in the practitioner world. And even if somebody tries to bring them in, they're sort of frowned upon they're because of this whole shift towards technicalization and individualization. So just specific to education, Jesha, what's been your experience with the way that the sector works now?
Yeah, I think I've definitely been one of those people who's like, hey, there's no easy solution to this, actually. And then, you know, crickets are chirping in the Zoom call, like, oh, here she is again. You know, what are we supposed to say to that? So anyway, I do think this issue is now sector-wide, because I think, you know, I mean, fundamentally, because of why the sector is the way it is, it's trying to solve certain problems that, you know, it may have itself created. So there's that. But apart from that, also with education, one thing I've seen a lot is, like, you know, I think it's interesting that Kapil actually comes from design, because a lot of people are trying to do like cross learnings from like, you know, sectors that may not earlier have served as inspiration, like, for example, visual design or architecture. You know, this is not, at least in the popular imagination or in the immediate association of development, you would not think of these together, but a lot of people are taking approaches and solutions from that. Similar, I think, you know, this behavioral economics, it's not always in the field of education, at least from what I know in India. A lot of it happens in health, or, you know, I mean, sometimes it's like sector agnostic in that sense, but a lot of it comes from, why I want to talk about education specifically is I really feel education outcomes are not the same easy packageable ROI wale outcomes as other sectors. You know, like, for example, with health or with livelihoods, like, Nishtha and I have worked in livelihoods in a different life or in a different phase of our lives. The stats on that were that we had to make sure XYZ number of people opened this many businesses, which is great. I mean, if you don't follow up on how the business you could follow up on how the business does, as some of us did. If you don't, your job ends there. The business is set up, the capital is put in, and the business is set up, and there's evidence of that. With education, you can't possibly have you know, learning outcomes increase in 2 years. Like, you can't even have them increase in, I mean, if you have them increase in 10 years, I really want to know what kind of intervention you're doing and what kind of sustained, like, longitudinal study that you've done. Like, this is one of my biggest problems with education specifically. I'm not sure, like, in the other areas, like sanitation or, you know, a shelter, these kind of areas, I think it's more of like something is done or some access is provided. And of course, we can talk about later, like, was that access constant? Was it equitable? That kind of thing. But you can see it in front of you. With education, it's very difficult to do that. And unfortunately, because everyone is sold on learning outcomes, and that's why the edtech industry is booming the way that we see it boom. It's very interesting to see like the intersection between for-profit edtech and non-profit edtech. Like that's also something that happens a lot. And essentially, I think they're prey to the same sort of thing. So with education, you really you can't do that, you know. So it's actually, I would say, a place where solutionism is especially not applicable. Like, I mean, you can say this many number of books provided, this many number of classrooms, but even the most experienced development sector hack can't convert that into a report unless, you know, like you can't put it in outcomes. You can't say, someone's science scores have increased because of this. And however much we talk about like alternative education and reimagining education, at the end, everyone just wants the increase in assessment. And it's usually math scores, language scores, like that kind of thing. Because we are in a very, very, very deep educational crisis in this country, like climate crisis level of things are on fire sort of crisis. And everyone is essentially like, because we are focusing on measuring things, essentially everyone gravitates towards that as the indicator, the scores. So I do feel this is the same thing. People are trying as much as they can to sort of piecemeal the different processes of education. Like for example, if there's a classroom and you're trying to measure how well kids are doing, maybe you don't measure learning outcomes. Maybe you measure number of teachers trained, you measure, number of study materials provided, what kind of classroom environment is it. You figure out ways to measure the how good the classroom environment is. So it is falling to the same sort of like behavioral sort of thing, like how can we nudge teachers to collect scores in a different way. So I think because like the main learning outcomes thing is so unachievable realistically, I'm not saying it's I think it's unachievable in the kind of time frames that development projects are used to. So I do see that in education as well. Interventions for me, because I worked in a different field, I haven't worked in health or any other sectors, I do feel interventions are a little different, or they choose what they want to focus on, and they sort of dance around the outcomes question in my opinion.
Jasha, I'm kind of curious then, what do you think is a realistic barometer for a successful education program? Like how do you define success in an education program, and should you define success in an education program? Just to give one personal example, I've been a part of a lot of different arts programs, like arts programs that have involved very key design skills. So not like arts program just from the perspective of let me teach you painting and drawing, but rather let me teach you creative processes which can lead to other livelihood opportunities. So this one particular art program that I used to volunteer for, they focused on printmaking. So they used to provide access to industrial level like printmaking for t-shirts. So like if students would come in, and a lot of the students that I was working with were homeless youth or coming from marginalized communities, so they're coming in, they're learning how to fundamentally learn what printmaking is, and as they're learning printmaking, they're understanding like basics of color matching, basics of design and composition. But the end output is now you've created something, like you've created a custom t-shirt that you can go sell to your friends, or you can go sell in within your community. And that's what really motivated a lot of students coming into the program. So if somebody asked me what was a marker of success for that program, like would I say that students who came out of that program are now even decent designers, or even like have the fundamentals of what is the beginning of becoming a good designer? I would say no. But I think just for them to understand how a skill can lead to a different opportunity for you, whether it's from more social capital in going up to your friends and wearing something that you've made, or simply just the aspect of selling something that you've made. So like for me, that was like a marker of success in that program. So I'm kind of curious, like, how do you kind of establish that marker? And yeah, even should we even establish a marker?
I think, Kapil, I would say in that situation, that does sound like a program that's got a clear pipeline towards something that is vocational you know, it sounds like the focus of that intervention was in the skilling and vocational space, which is also something that's gaining a lot of popularity. Where I was coming from was the fact that I have worked in, you know, public education strengthening sort of programs. So working alongside with governments to improve the quality of education in government schools. And in interventions like that, the question that you asked, what would be the marker of success? I fundamentally think that to target one aspect of the process of education and then to extrapolate that and say that, you know, it's going to have a magnified effect on learning outcomes, I think that's a bit of a stretch to make. And people do aim for that in the long term. Like, for example, you can say it through like training teachers. Okay, like suppose teachers are better trained in classroom management strategies, or they receive material that like curriculum material where there was more gender sensitization, there's more content. I know an organization working on that, targeted towards this age of children, then their attitudes towards gender will change later. You know, I mean, I do think hypothetically, these are nice scenarios that we want to imagine, that, you know, you intervene at a leadership level and then that same thing trickles down into the classroom and then that improves learning outcomes. I don't know if the data is with us on that. And I don't know if, forget the data is with us on that. I don't know if there's any will from either funders or NGOs to really design and conduct like a proper, like a study that's actually like verifiable to prove that kind of thing. I know I'm getting very data about it, but I mean, that is the case. Like we do need to at least understand, you know, why we are choosing, not just the scope for choosing a certain intervention, but after the scope also truly finding out that, okay, you know what, maybe this intervening at one level didn't work. So I think what I'm trying to say is that I don't think at all that there should be, like, I think education is like it's a myriad different things, and a good intervention, if there is such a thing, would target several processes of it or several parts of it. For example, I'll give you a government example itself. The government of Haryana has a program called Saksham Haryana, and that involves, you know, assessing all children's learning levels and, you know, understanding where they are at. Like, I think this is also a push, like a baseline, to do a baseline. This is a push from the policy side as well. Except that assessment takes 6 hours, and this is for primary school children. So even if you do need to collect data, like even if we somehow do argue that this is the way to collect data, this is just an example of how sometimes the assessment itself, you know, may be something that's not received well by a lot of people, or the data collected from it is also unreliable, you know. So I do think because there's so much of a push on assessments as the way to collect data, we need to A, think of whether that assessment is really necessary, whether the learning outcome assessment is necessary, and B, fundamentally rethink how education programs are planned in the first place to say that, you know, we fix this one thing and the rest of the system will get fixed because of the I keep saying trickle down, but I mean the amplified effect of it on everything else. Yeah,
I actually wanted to discuss that a bit more. When they talk about education, right, everyone always speaks in India about education as the root cause of all other problems. And it's very difficult to talk about education without associating it with how you'll have better outcomes and everything else. So if you talk about health, people are like, people are uneducated. That's why health outcomes are low. Or unemployment is labor away, because education low, illiteracy. But over time, especially as we've seen that states' ke outcome measures of education are changing, it's actually not having much impact either on health or on employment. And I wanted to talk about that because I feel like that's also a very political discourse where the government sort of pushes the idea that because, you know, like individually families are not educated enough or they're not educating enough, that's why baki indicators they're falling short. Whereas that isn't, for me, that isn't the point of education. Like, education can be seen separate to these problems, and these problems need a solution, but education is not necessarily the solution for that. And I wanted to hear your thoughts.
That makes me and I'm sure my colleagues also in education feel so important, because I love how the buck stops with education, and education people are convinced that yes, it is our divine duty to do it. Like, there's nowhere to go from here. Like, we have to solve for education, and then all these other things will come in line, you know. So I've never heard anyone in education saying, oh, the real problem is that, you know, their parents are unemployed or something. No, it's always that children have to go to school, they should go to school. And of course, I want to clarify, obviously, like, you know, education is a good thing. I mean, we are here sitting here because we are highly educated and we have certain opportunities and access that others don't, of course, because of our position in the caste and class hierarchy as well. I really agree with you in the sense that it's, I think, a symptom of the same thing to find one particular root cause for the rest of society's problems as being uneducated or, you know, something like that. And I also think, like, in popular culture, it's a very common thing to say, even an educated person is doing X, Y, Z terrible thing. Like, you know, even with so much education, they are doing this. Whereas we know that the type of education that we get, like, there is almost no correlation with someone's maybe moral or values or even their decisions. What you specifically said about education and employment, the kind of crisis we are facing in this country has college graduates and even master's graduates not being employed. So it does not actually correlate that the more you study, the you know, you'll get a job. Like, the economic crisis and is much deeper than that. I spoke to a principal in Punjab whose main motivation, like, he was the principal of a high school, and it was his life's purpose or his main motivation to stay back with the kids after school, tell them that they need to escape the cycle of poverty by, you know, appearing for government exams, and to train them for exams, tell them when the dates are, and just give them one shot. Just say, after 12th, this is what you do. This is the exam you write. This is what you get to. I really enjoyed listening to him and talking to him, because while I may not agree, you know, with how he chose to do it or the fact that he presented this one life path to kids, he had the essentially the right idea, which is that it's kind of like a funnel. Like, if you don't do anything at the class 12 level, like, if you just put kids in school and say the important thing is all kids have to be in school, which they should, but you're ignoring how schools are, you're ignoring how education is, you're ignoring the way the landscape of this country changes economically, unless there's some kind of intervention make sure the education you get directly correlates into certain opportunities. And that's not going to come without guidance. And that has its own structural issues as well. Like, there may be a day, and I'm sure there are children in his batches that don't get government jobs because there are less government jobs or there are less permanent government jobs than there were earlier, you know, seats nahi hai or something like that. So I definitely think that it is definitely a flawed and, frankly, like, a little bit of a, it's also a little bit of a save the children sort of development communication sort of thing, like a little paternalistic sort of view that we have to save all these children by putting them in school and they get midday meals. Like, it's important, like, as a policy to have them, but the quality of teaching, like, there are so many different factors at play that it's not, you know, the short way to a better life, which is what a lot of the development communication around it says.
We discussed this earlier also. We can talk a bit about the whole Teach for India model, because I think that really drives the imagination of a lot of kids, especially in the 11th, 12th bachelor's way, when it's seen as, like, you know, the good thing to do after your bachelor's, just sort of enter those 2 years and teach a lot of kids in primary schools. And so many people I know who've gone and done that then speak about education in a manner that they know best because they spent those 2 years. And I think that influences a lot of the discourse as well that I have encountered. And we can talk about that and then talk a bit more about just the way that policy is seen as well. And I think that, you know, that extension of this individualization narrative has gone too far in the policy circles as well, where all these policies are now seen very separate from one another. They're not really seen as a holistic, like, classical development would have looked at all these different parameters to then push the nation forward towards, you know, like economic growth. But now with the private market, with a lot of the other economic changes that are going on, it's just like all of these have been segregated by the government itself. And then different NGOs are working on different things. And there's more of a push ki private players ko leke aao, design agencies ko leke aao, you solve for education, you solve for employment, the third person solves for sanitation. And even the government doesn't have like this, you know, like a big 5-year plan of kahan ja rahe desh. But yeah, maybe start from, teach from India and then scale upwards.
I love how we're really getting personal now with Teach for India. My love to all the TFI colleagues and friends who are watching this. I do agree. I understand that teaching children is a very emotional and bonding experience. I have experienced the same thing as well. Although I do feel that a lot of people who have these fellowships that essentially give you like a breather or a taster of, you know, what it means to sort of be in the front lines of social change, or like, you know, to be very much in the schools that so-called need improving so that, you know, the children of India can study better, are also very aware of the kind of structural issues. Like, I think the notes that they've brought back from the field or from their work, it inevitably informs you about the kinds of issues that are there with like school administrations, funding, teachers, principals, everything. And, you know, and TFI's model itself, how it works. Essentially, it's inserting, you know, or creating like a parallel sort of set of teachers in schools. And while that is helpful to children, there are a lot of internal politics in schools as well, because sometimes the TFI classrooms start maybe doing better, and that's not always, you know, something that's appreciated. And anyway, I do feel in public education, there's not enough, I would say, empathy for what teachers and principals are already going through that makes them, you know, so-called their classrooms not hit learning outcomes and all. Like, there is certain amount of empathy only till you, to get them to accept your intervention, to get them to introduce whatever you need them to introduce in your classroom so that your program is a success. But I don't think there's enough just like, you know, to sit with the kind of 50 different pressures that they have to go through, something they get from the state government, something they get from the central government. And a lot of teachers are women. So the kind of, you know, balancing act that they do, filling in children's marks at home, feeding their own kids, sending them to school. So there's a lot of that. And I do know that, you know, these fellowships, open people's mind to that sort of thing. The coping mechanism that I've seen and that I greatly appreciate is, and I think people do in classrooms as well, is just to put your head down and focus on the kids, on your teaching. Like, you can either go the scale route and say, yeah, I'm going to fix the entire education system. At the end of the day, you may come back to something you love, which is teaching a few kids. And in a way, I do think that's a lovely change to make, which is you focus on what you can manage. And I do think there's a lot of notes in this for a lot of startup CEOs and NGOs as well, because I personally despise the scale question. I do feel it's like at the root of a lot of issues of funding and the kind of imagination people have for their NGOs.
So I'm going to ask you one last question, which we ask everyone who comes on the show, which is, what is one memory from the sector that you think could make a good episode for a sitcom?
I would like to let you know that I have critiqued Better Life Foundation, not yet Panchayat, for cornering this NGO antics market, because I'm always like, yeah, I could write a better show. I could write another show because I have so much material. So yeah, this is something I've thought about a lot. I want to share just some things that I feel corporate people will just never relate to, never understand. So as you know, salaries are often delayed, right? And by salaries are delayed, I've never gotten a salary before the 1st. Like, people I know in the corporate get it on the 30th, which is insane to me, like, which is just absolutely wild. It'll be 15th and I'll be like, yeah, I don't know. Like, I'll delay rent, like, or I paid it with last month's thing or something like that. So there was a time in which I was working for an organization where the salaries were delayed, or rather I would say the funds were not disbursed. Like, you know, there are the funds. We all know the funds are there. And it was blocked by some kind of dam of paperwork or whatever. And in the end, after, you know, a lot of cajoling the gatekeeper of the funds, or the person who would make it easier to get out the funds from a big bureaucracy, we got our salaries, which is fine. And then, as a thank you to the person who oiled the machine and got our salaries out, we all were told to pose with a sweet little note of motivation on a page and take photos and say thank you so much, and I have the photo, and we did it. Okay, so thank you for this. And, you know, like a little smiley face, someone's putting a little more effort in their thing. You know, it feels like you're making a birthday video, but like it's for your own salary to be paid to you. So love that. Just a very, and I don't even think it was that. Honestly, there was another organization I joined where my salary was late because I was new. I didn't even say anything. Like the first, I'm just like, "Haan, hoga late." Matlab, kya pata? 20 tarikh hai, koi baat nahi. Hogi. Yeah. And then I told someone, and they were like, "Why didn't you ask why your salary is late?" I was just like, "Oh, I didn't want to make another thank you note, you know, like something like that." So that was one. I gotta share one more because it was adorable. This is something from the field that we learned. This is regarding a government officer who was very, very strong on field work and went to a district of the state that borders another state. Without knowing, he crossed into the other state, okay, without knowing this. And he did a school inspection in that school and started looking at the textbooks and being like, "Ye kaun sa language hai?" Because of अलग स्टेट का था. एंड देन समवन वाज लाइक, "सर, हम उस स्टेट में नहीं है." एंड इमेजिन दिस स्कूल इज जस्ट लाइक, "अफसर आ गए हैं तो करा लो इंस्पेक्शन." इंस्टेड ऑफ बीइंग लाइक, "हु आर यू, व्हिच स्टेट हैव यू कम फ्रॉम?" इट्स जस्ट लाइक, "चाय पानी पिला दो इनको, मिड डे मील की टेस्टिंग करा दो, लाइक जस्ट गो थ्रू द मोशंस, यू नो." एंड ही इज जस्ट सिटिंग इन क्लास लाइक जस्ट ओपनिंग कॉपीज एंड इट्स नॉट इन अ लैंग्वेज दैट ही अंडरस्टैंड्स. I loved it. I loved it so much.
Love this too. No, I especially related to your salary payment wala issue, because this is something like, even as someone who's not doing a job, who's managing a company, like this is something that recently happened to us. Like, we were working with an organization, a very large organization, and we had an invoice pending with them for a fairly long period of time. So I had sent a message, and the invoice was like due after, like it was sent 2 months before, and we still hadn't had any communication. I'd sent multiple reminders, and it's more weird, right? You can't just come in and come up to a client that you have an active relationship, be like, "Hey man, my money's due." And I have a friend who works in the garment industry, and like, this is the biggest piece of advice that I ever learned from him, because he would get his payment a year, 6 months after like it was due. And I started to expect that this is what the social sector is as well. It's like, I've sold you 100 t-shirts, and at some point money will come. It's just, I cannot trouble you because you will get pissed off. And the funny part was, so I didn't bother them for like a good 3 months. And after 3 months, you have to send them a polite reminder. Just legally, you have to send a reminder. And they came back and said like, "Oh, what invoice? We don't have an invoice over due." And they forgot. They just forgot that they had to pay us. They forgot that there was an invoice pending, and if I didn't raise it, I wouldn't have gotten the money. So yeah,
ऐसे बहुत भाईचारा भी चलता है सेक्टर में, ये भी देखा मैंने. They expected both of employees and of each other. They're just like, "भाई भाई सब चलता है, हम सब भलाई तो कर रहे हैं, चलो साथ में भला करेंगे." Yeah, no, and it's also like, I mean, at some level, it might be like, you know, you could say it's a desi impulse, but it's not. I've seen it in the dev sector. There are a lot of foreigners who will come in and will be working here as managers of the organization, and then they start expecting it from you. And I'm like, "Yeah, subtle tones of, you know, like exploitation are there." Like, "We're all doing good here." I'm like, from a very different context, you know. This is not the same equation at all. Okay. Well, moving on to our absolute last question, Jaisha. Just what are, we'd like to know, what are the general emotions you've had through your journey in the dev sector, and then what's next for you moving forward?
I love that you asked me this, because I think in teams, I've definitely been the one who does the check-ins and say, how are we all feeling? So like, let's just describe one word to say how we all feel. And my word was always something like tired. And everyone found that really strange. And I'm just like, but I'm being real. I am tired, you know? So I do feel there has been a lot of frustration for me, for sure. The one source of inspiration, or something that I've always really liked, like even though structurally I'm still not on board with the entire concept of this sector, I would say, and what's next for me, is that I am not sure how much I'll be engaging with the sector in the future. Or I would really, really want to cherry pick my interactions. I would really want to see who I work with, who I engage with. It's giving me hope that a lot of people who are maybe a little further into their careers, one fresh out of college, like you and Kapil, are also thinking along the same lines and are thinking about, you know, like deeper issues that need to be fixed in the sector. So I think I would make exceptions for things like that, but otherwise I'm gonna do the reverse engineering MBA route. Not that I can go back and study engineering MBA, but you know, probably move to other pastures. I do feel though that I really feel strongly about like research and storytelling being really a part of the core part of anything that's done. And by that I mean like genuinely making programs according to people on the ground and understanding complexity, not just as a buzzword, you know, about complex systems, but truly understanding complexity, you know, politics and everything, understanding how it's affecting the landscape of this country. So I would just like to say that in the past few years, that has been an important source of learning for me, going on the field, understanding, or just getting to talk to people. I feel like it's a privilege to even get their time. And kabhi kabhi gaali bhi diya unhone, but justified bhi hai, I would say. So along with frustration, there is hope in some weird twisted way, but definitely not from the sector, I would say. just hope that maybe work can be more focused on what communities need and on history and yeah, the current situation of things. It's not very articulate, but yeah.
No, thanks so much for sharing that with us.
Thanks, Jesha. It was a pleasure hearing your stories.
Yeah.
And I'll wait for your sitcom. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, always a pleasure. Thanks, Jesha.